somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 22, Fighting Words, Free Speech in 18th Century America, Part 2. This is Part 2 of the History of Free Speech in 18th Century America. So if you haven't done so already, I recommend you go back and listen to episode 21 before delving into this one. There may also be some of you who wonder why I went straight to events in America from the early Enlightenment in Europe in episode 20. Am I really going to just ignore what happened on the continent in the 18th century and leave out people like Voltaire, the philosophe, Immanuel Kant, and other European Enlightenment bigwigs? Oh, and that minor incident that goes by the name of the French Revolution? The answer is no. The reason why I chose to go down the American fork in the historical road is because 1776 comes before 1789. Once I've covered the American Revolution and the adoption of the Bill of Rights in two episodes' time, I'll circle back across the Atlantic and survey where the church and state were able to fight off the infection of the early Enlightenment ideas. So, yes, Voltaire, Diderot, Kant, Rousseau, Strunze, take a mental note of that name, Strunze, and of course the French Revolution, are very much on what will likely be a 3 or 4 episode menu to be prepared and devoured this spring and summer. In 1815, an 80-year-old John Adams looked back at the American Revolution in a letter to his old frenemy, Thomas Jefferson.
What do we mean by the revolution? The war? That was no part of the revolution. It was only an effect and consequence of it. The revolution was in the minds of the people, and this was effected in the course of 15 years before a drop of blood was shed.
So to Adams, the decisive battlegrounds of the revolution were not Lexington or Yorktown, but newspapers and pamphlets where the fighting was done with pens and paper, not guns and steel. And the prize on offer was the public opinion, not enemy territory. Historian Bernard Balin calls pamphlets the distinct literature of the revolution and the venue where the ideological positions were shaped as the conflict unfolded. And as we'll see, some pamphlets gained such massive reach that they even helped change the course of history. So what was the extent and nature of pamphlet wars? What were the rules of engagement when firing paper bullets? Well, more than 400 pamphlets addressed the souring relationship between Britain and the American colonies in the years between 1750 and 1776. In 1783, the number had skyrocketed to 1,500. Pamphlets were long enough to allow complex arguments to be unpacked, but they were also shorter, punchier, and faster to read, write, and print than books. So in a certain sense, pamphlets were the 18th century version of Twitter and Facebook. Social media algorithms fueled content that involved controversy and conflict. And dramatic events like the Stamp Act, the Boston Massacre, and the Tea Act also fired up pamphleteers and printers on both sides of the conflict. And if you imagine pamphleteering as polite debate among learned individuals adhering to a strict code of reasoned argumentation in stark contrast to the flaming, trolling, name-calling, motivated reasoning, and butchering of straw men that is Twitter, you'll be disappointed. Pamphlet wars often started out with reasoning and arguments, but they quickly descended into, well, flaming, trolling, name-calling, motivated reasoning, and the butchering of straw men, in chains of pamphlets, replying to each other in increasingly shrill language. So political tribalism, or factionalism, was well and alive in the 18th century. One pamphleteer wrote of John Hancock, "Though nature had bestowed upon him a human figure, she had denied him the powers of manhood." And as we shall see, this was in the very mild end of insults. So pamphlets were the most important means of influencing public opinion from the 1760s and throughout the conflict. But there was also an increase in books and newspapers. Records show that imprints rose from 68 in 1700 to 798 in 1789. But when newspaper issues are added, the total for 1790 explodes to more than 8,000. The data also shows a marked development in who got to communicate to the public through print technology. In the early 1700s, local governments were responsible for around 90% of recorded imprints. But when things heated up in the 1760s, government share of print issues had fallen to 11% in hotbeds of dissent like Boston and New York. Books also proliferated, many of them imported from the mother country. In fact, by 1770, England exported more books to America than continental Europe and the rest of the world combined. Which makes me think of a quote attributed to Lenin, who supposedly said that the capitalists will sell us the rope with which we will hang them. Because as we saw in the last episode, marginal English writers like the authors of the Cato's letters became sensations when their ideas were exported to America and contributed to the steady buildup of revolutionary dissent that ultimately dissolved the political bands between Britain and America. The number of North American newspapers also grew from 12 to 99 from 1750 to 1790, with a huge spike from the dramatic 1760s. In other words, print technology and changing attitudes to authority and the rights of freeborn Englishmen, or even the rights of man, had democratized the budding public sphere. This is how one contemporary observer described Americans in the 1770s.
"They are well-informed, reasoning people too, perhaps the most of any on earth, because of the free intercourse between man and man that prevails in America. Their frequent and free elections, which give occasion for candidates to scan each other's principle and conduct before the tribunal of the people, together with the freedom and general circulation of newspapers and the eagerness and leisure of the people to read them or listen to those who do."
The ideas that were circulated in pamphlets and newspapers were amplified by another import from the mother country. As we saw in the last episode, English coffee houses became egalitarian chat rooms or Facebook groups, where high and low could meet and discuss everything from news to politics and science, taking their cue from newspapers and pamphlets supplied by the local coffee pushers. The first American coffee house opened in New York in 1696. And the King's Arms was like a magnet for the city's middle to upper class, a place to read the newest pamphlets and papers and discuss the most recent ideas from Europe. But it seems Americans were hooked on alcohol as well as caffeine, so both taverns and coffee houses became dens of dissent. By 1752, thirsty inhabitants of Boston could choose between an impressive 162 different taverns. The importance of coffee houses and taverns for new ideas to spread and germinate cannot be understated. So Charles II was absolutely right to fear them, as we saw in the last episode. Pamphlets like Common Sense could only change the course of the revolution because they were read, distributed, and discussed at the local tavern or coffee house, providing viral writings that reached way beyond the actual number of prints and purchases. In the 1750s, patrons at James Pitson's tavern were spoiled for choice with 38 pamphlets and 88 books on offer. The radicalization of politics in the lead-up to the revolution was also intimately linked with the tavern. In 1665, the year the Stamp Act ignited an American powder keg, 89 men had a license to sell alcohol in Boston. 20 of them happened to be members of the Sons of Liberty, a secretive group of radical patriots founded to undermine British colonial rule and fight taxation without representation. As a loyalist complained, people attend
at taverns, where they talk politics, get drunk, damn king, ministers and taxes, and vow they will follow any measure proposed to them by their demagogues, however repugnant to religion, reason, and common sense.
The American statesman Daniel Webster even dubbed the Green Dragon Tavern in Boston as the headquarters of the revolution, because it was the favorite hangout of the local Sons of Liberty, including Paul Revere, Samuel Adams, and John Hancock, who hatched plans and plotted the defeat of the hated Redcoats while high on a potent mix of coffee, rum, and Cato's letters. According to some sources, the Boston Tea Party may even have been orchestrated at the Green Dragon Tavern. The Revolutionary Descent, a term I've stolen from Stephen Solomon's book of that very title and which I can't recommend enough, did not materialize out of thin air. We've already seen that radical Whig political philosophy was deeply influential, and that influence only grew stronger with the founding generation. Josiah Quincy, also a member of the Sons of Liberty, listed the books he wanted his son to inherit from his personal library.
I give to my son, when he shall arrive to the age of 15 years, Algernon Sidney's works, John Locke's works, Lord Bacon's works, Gordon's Tacitus, and Cato's letters. May the spirit of liberty rest upon him.
The revolutionary literature also overflows with references to classical Greek and Roman writers like Thucydides, Demosthenes, Cato, and Cicero. Many patriots saw a direct parallel between their own time and the decline of the Roman Republic. In the words of John Dickinson, who would become the most influential pamphleteer prior to Tom Paine, Britain was to America what Caesar was to Rome. Now, contemporary classicists would flunk the founders' writings as being pretty ahistorical. But the references to the classics provided a strong sense of historical legitimacy to a radical experiment that broke with authority and tradition. The founders liked to mix up the ancient ideas of antiquity with cutting-edge thinking of Europe's leading Enlightenment thinkers like Voltaire, Rousseau, Beccaria, Montesquieu, and David Hume. And this included ideas on free speech. In the first edition of Essays Moral, Political, and Literary from 1742, David Hume somewhat exaggerated when he wrote that
nothing is more apt to surprise a foreigner than the extreme liberty which we enjoy in this country of communicating whatever we please to the public and of openly censuring every measure entered into by the king or his ministers.
But then again, England did enjoy a much freer press than most other European countries. Like Cato's letters, Hume saw free speech as a protection against ministerial despotism or encroachments on men's rights. Hume also asked himself whether the unlimited exercise of this liberty was advantageous or prejudicial to the public. After weighing the various dangers, he concluded that such a liberty is attended with so few inconveniences that it may be claimed as the common right of mankind. A free press, however abused, can scarce ever excite popular tumults or rebellion. He even declared that the laws of seditious libel had gone as far as they could without causing a barefaced violation of liberty of the press. Only ecclesiastical governments and priestcraft would suffer from press freedom. This was sweet music to the confirmation bias of the patriots who thumped their pens and noses at seditious libel laws. But then in 1770, Hume changed tack and backpedaled. Suddenly free speech was no longer harmless. Instead, unbounded liberty of the press was one of the evils associated with mixed forms of government. Though Hume still saw it as a necessary evil arising out of a greater good and did not advocate a return to censorship. In any event, Hume's backpedaling hardly registered with American patriots. An unedited version of his earlier civil libertarian essay without his reasoned misgivings kept circulating all over America under the title The Celebrated Mr. Hume's Observation on the Liberty of the Press. A little filtering never hurt free speech, right? The French nobleman Baron Montesquieu was another hugely respected author whose contributions to a more robust understanding of free speech chimed perfectly with the patriot side. Montesquieu was cited in pamphlet after pamphlet. And in 1790, Thomas Jefferson listed him as one of the five most essential readings for a young man going into law. Montesquieu's sensational work, De l'Esprit des Lois, is most famous for articulating the idea of the separation of powers. But the fundamental importance of both freedom of speech and the press runs through the book like a red thread. One of Montesquieu's essential contributions was an attempt to separate words from actions, an overt acts theory, if you like.
Words do not constitute an overt act. They remain only an idea. Since there can be nothing so equivocal and ambiguous as all this, how is it possible to convert it into a crime of high treason? Wherever this law is established, there's an end not only of liberty, but even of its very shadow.
What made Montesquieu even more attractive was that he too appealed to ancient Roman history. Like Cato's letters, he highlighted the increasingly intolerant rule of the first emperors Augustus and Tiberius, who punished even poetry and satire as the capital crime of high treason. This was evidence of the intimate link between despotism and the persecution of mere words. To Montesquieu, diversity of opinion was an advantage, not a danger to states. So governments should rather fear the stifling uniformity that went hand in hand with censorship. A free people had to be possessed of judgment and a facility in communicating their thoughts. Montesquieu also rejected the idea of avenging the deity, who must be left to avenge his own cause, which was a clever way to undermine punishments for heresy and blasphemy. Though careful as ever, Montesquieu did, after all, live in ancient regime France, but he didn't rule out punishments for heresy, but left the scope for this crime so small as to be virtually invisible. There is, of course, one issue which just so plainly undermined the principles and rhetoric of the Patriot side as to defy all logic. The descending colonists constantly contrasted their ideal of liberty with slavery. By this, they didn't mean that Parliament in London would round up American colonists, put them in chains, and ship them to faraway lands to toil away under the crack of whips for the rest of their days. You know, like the black Africans who actually toiled away under the crack of whips on the plantations of many a prominent patriot, including Washington and Jefferson. Instead, they meant Parliament's imposition of taxation without representation and other laws and disabilities that limited the rights and privileges of American colonists. In the words of Dickinson, "Those who are taxed without their own consent, expressed by themselves or their representatives, are slaves." It should be said that there were a few, like James Otis and of course Tom Paine, who saw and pointed out that American complaints about British slavery were pretty absurd, given that most of those fearful of being enslaved by George III were happy to keep black Africans enslaved themselves. The cognitive dissonance of these brilliant thinkers who changed the world for the better is just maddening. Here they were, fighting for a radical new society based on freedom, while subjugating hundreds of thousands of people to appalling human bondage that made a mockery out of the comparatively trifling complaints that caused the colonists to rebel in the first place. But before you say, why the F should we care about free speech when those who championed this freedom for themselves sold human beings as chattel? Let me note that the principle of free speech would be used to great effect by abolitionists like Frederick Douglass, who later saw a link between the denial of free speech and slavery. But that's in a later episode. Despite the expanding public sphere in North America, the crime of seditious libel remained a staple of English common law. In the 1760s, the conservative jurist, judge, and politician William Blackstone wrote his hugely influential commentary on the laws of England. Blackstone was fully behind the liberty of the press. No, really. He found it
essential to the nature of a free state, but
always fear the but.
This consists in laying no previous restraints upon publications and not in freedom from censure for criminal matter when published. Every free man has an undoubted right to lay what sentiments he pleases before the public. To forbid this is to destroy the freedom of the press. But if he publishes what is improper, mischievous, or illegal, he must take the consequence of his own temerity.
In other words, freedom of speech means only the right to publish whatever you want without prior censorship, not protection from punishment if you cross the red lines of seditious libel, blasphemy, or other speech crimes. Blackstone's logic was bulletproof. A man may be allowed to keep poisons in his closet, but not publicly to vent them as cordials. In fact, Blackstone explained, so true will it be found that to censure the licentiousness is to maintain the liberty of the press. So prosecuting someone for criticizing the government was really a defense of press freedom, because everyone knows that reading seditious words is the same as drinking poison. But as we saw in the last episode, prosecutions for seditious libel in America had been fatally wounded by the Sanger case and popular resistance to undermining the bulwark of liberty. So when the first explosion in the chain reaction that led to war and independence erupted in 1764, British authorities were effectively powerless to stop the onslaught of patriot sentiment that followed the announcement of the Stamp Act. The British won the 7 Years' War, also known as the French and Indian War, in 1763, and with it a gigantic swath of French territories in America. But wars are expensive. Luckily for the British, their loyal American colonists would gratefully chip in to sustain the empire that had just defended them from the threat of greedy French colonial ambitions on the continent. Well, not really. When the British government announced a new tax in 1765, the crisis came to a head. The notorious Stamp Act was basically a tax on paper, requiring all paper to be bought and stamped from a government agent. In concrete terms, a lawyer had to pay as much as £10 for a lawyer's license, and a printer was taxed half a penny for every half sheet he used to print newspapers, pamphlets, and broadsides. Anyone caught using unstamped paper was fined as much as £10 for every offence, and would be tried in odious vice-admiralty courts with no juries. In other words, printers and lawyers carried the burden of the new tax. And as the government was about to learn the hard way, lawyers and printer journalists are the last group of people you want to enrage and unite in a PR battle for hearts and minds. In Revolutionary Dissent, Stephen Solomon argues that
for the development of freedom of speech and press in colonial America, the Stamp Act protests would be the most important formative event. The printing press was the engine moving the protests forward, with newspapers and pamphlets enjoying wide distribution throughout the colonies.
And colonial newspapers orchestrated a tsunami of dissent. In September, the mysterious constitutional current went viral in the streets of New York, due largely to two anonymous essays. They thundered against the vile minions of tyranny and the chains of abject slavery just ready to be riveted about our necks. The two writers invited the Americans to never pay one farthing of this tax. They also called the local stamp collectors vipers of humankind, who were themselves guilty of the mob violence they suffered at patriot hands. Not that these authors actually encouraged violence. Of course not. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. The first page of The Current recycled an old Benjamin Franklin cartoon of a large snake cut into pieces representing the colonies and a cap-locked invitation to join or die. A good example of how symbolic expression would come to play an important role in shaping public opinion. The Current quickly found its way to Boston and Philadelphia, and others followed suit. John Dickinson, then a young lawyer in Philadelphia, called for civil disobedience. If you comply with the act by using stamped papers, you fix, you rivet perpetual chains upon your unhappy country. Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette agreed and issued a whole edition on unstamped paper. No stamped paper to be had, it declared dryly. In New Haven, the Connecticut Gazette helped popularize Franklin's now famous quote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." It splashed this quote across the front page, although Franklin had actually made the comment in an entirely different context that had nothing to do with civil liberties or freedom of the press. But no one more systematically undermined the Stamp Act than Benjamin Eads and John Gill, the irascible editors of the Boston Gazette. Hashtag the resistance. Eads and Gill had already been in trouble in the 1750s for printing writings that offended the Puritan establishment. Back then, they apologized and promised to mend their ways. But when the Stamp Act was announced, they launched an unapologetic crusade against the designs of Parliament. They featured pieces by people like John and Samuel Adams, James Otis, and James Warren. And did I mention that the masthead of the Gazette was designed by Paul Revere? Or that Eads was a member of the Sons of Liberty that hung out and self-radicalized in the revolutionary echo chamber of the Green Dragon Tavern? So you can probably guess whether the Gazette's coverage of the Stamp Act was fair and balanced. The Gazette called supporters of the Stamp Act dirty sycophants, ministerial hacks, detestable villains, and insatiable vultures, among many, many, many other insults. But the Boston Gazette also published highly eloquent and principled commentary, like this one by John Adams, who saw in the Stamp Act an attempt to silence colonial dissent.
The jaws of power are always open to devour, and her arms is always stretched out, if possible, to destroy the freedom of thinking, speaking, and writing. Be not intimidated, therefore, by any terrors from publishing with the utmost freedom whatever can be warranted by the laws of your country. It seems very manifest from the Stamp Act itself that a design is formed to strip us in a great measure of the means of knowledge by loading the press, the colleges, and even an almanac and a newspaper with restraints and duties.
The Lieutenant Governor of New York warned headquarters back in London that the colonial newspapers were
filled with every falsehood that malice could invent to serve their purpose of exciting the people to disobedience of the laws and to sedition. At first, they only denied the authority of Parliament to lay internal taxes in the colonies. But at last, they have denied the legislative authority of the Parliament in the colonies, and these papers continue to be published.
Still, the message to London was that prosecuting these trumpeters of sedition was not advisable, as it might create a violent backlash. The Patriot case against the Stamp Act, and in favor of popular sovereignty, was also helped by the spread of some genuine fake news. In Virginia, the Patriot firebrand Patrick Henry, he of Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death, drafted a series of fiery resolutions opposing the Stamp Act. Some of them more than flirted with rebellion, because Henry insisted that colonists were free to ignore tax laws not imposed by their own representatives. He tabled the so-called Virginia Resolves in Virginia's assembly, the House of Burgesses. After fierce debate, Henry's famous oratory genius managed to browbeat a slim majority into passing five of the resolutions, while two were rejected as too extreme. But the next day, the House got cold feet and rescinded the most radical of the resolutions that had actually passed. But Henry's spirit was already out of the bottle, and there was no putting it back in. When Northerners opened their newspapers over the summer, they were fed Henry's recipe for resistant shock therapy rather than the diluted prescription for polite dialogue that had actually been passed. Because the Newport Mercury in Rhode Island just went ahead and printed six resolutions, including the call for resistance, as if all were adopted by the House of Burgesses. And needless to say, the naughty editors of the Boston Gazette copied the article from the Mercury, which then spread to other newspapers, like fake news disseminated by a Russian troll factory on Facebook. The truth didn't stand a chance. The loyalist Virginia Gazette tried to combat the disinformation and tell the real story. Its editor called the Northern articles destitute of truth and promised to undeceive them with facts. But no one cared about these minor details, which might ruin the sensational story of how Virginia's assembly had thrown down the gauntlet. And soon the radical Virginia resolves were actually turned from fiction into fact, as eight colonies passed similar resolutions. This is when the governor of Massachusetts hit the alarm button. The fake resolutions had raised the spirit of rebellion and roused up the Boston politicians and been the occasion of insolent pieces in the popular newspapers. Newspapers like the Boston Gazette provided the script and talking points of the resistance to the Stamp Act, which found fertile ground among the general population, expanding the public sphere beyond the printing press. Again, Solomon is worth quoting.
The colonists opposing the Stamp Act met in taverns, town meetings, and public squares, and they sent their representatives to a Congress of the colonies. They wrote letters, drafted resolutions, and sent petitions to King George III. They wrote verse and drew political cartoons. They adopted powerful symbols like liberty trees, hanged effigies of hated politicians, and assembled in demonstrations and parades. Ministers spoke from pulpits and political leaders from platforms.
This went hand in hand with a growing attachment to the idea of popular sovereignty, in which freedom of expression was necessary for colonists to effectively rule themselves and deliberate issues of common concern. So you might say that this was a period of both American isegoria and paresia. But one of the frustrating things about free speech is that no matter how eloquent and insistently you make your point, someone is always going to disagree and come up with a counterargument. And sure enough, there were loyalists who weren't persuaded that the Stamp Act was a conspiracy to strip Americans of their rights as freeborn Englishmen and turn them into the dependent slaves of Parliament and blood-sucking ministers back in London. But those who refused to be persuaded by words could be persuaded by other means. Violent mob action broke out in Boston in August 1765 and spread to other colonies. One victim of these mobs described how the press was constantly fanning the flames of intimidation.
As a prelude to the destruction and disorder made by these mobs, the printers in each colony, almost without exception, stuffed their papers weekly for some time before with the most inflammatory pieces they could procure and excluded everything that tended to cool the minds of the people.
And those who used the printed word to incite the mobs were not above participating themselves. As a founding member of the Loyal Nine, which would morph into the Sons of Liberty, Benjamin Eads helped organize protests against the Stamp Act, including one that culminated with the lynching of effigies representing the local stamp collector in Boston, as well as the British Prime Minister and the Devil. These effigies were hung by the neck from an old elm tree in the middle of town. According to the Boston Gazette's coverage of the event, some thousands met by nightfall to parade the lynched dolls through the streets of Boston. Comparing someone with the devil in Puritan Boston was not done lightly, and it proved an ominous sign of the depth of American dissent. And these tactics spread beyond Boston. So needless to say, stamp collectors throughout the colonies suddenly agreed that the Stamp Act was an act of oppression in which they would play no part. And as a result, the enforcement of the act became all but impossible. In order to truly popularize protests, it's not enough to rouse the chattering classes who read pamphlets and newspapers. The lowly commoners also need to get on board. This is where symbolic speech became key. Protesters used creative symbols like flags and emblems. But somehow the elm tree was what struck the patriots' collective imagination. The tree was already an old English symbol of liberty going back to the Middle Ages. And on September 11th, when the Loyal Nine heard the news of Prime Minister Lord Grenville's resignation in London, they returned to the elm tree where they had lynched the effigies and affixed a plate naming it the Tree of Liberty. And after the incident in Boston, liberty trees spread everywhere from New England to Georgia. New Yorkers put their own unique twist on the symbol, replacing the trees with tall masts and declaring them liberty poles. In 1770, the British General Gage reported that
"It is now as common here to assemble on all occasions of public concern at the Liberty Pole and Coffee House as for the ancient Romans to repair to the Forum, and orators harangue on all sides."
The combination of eloquent commentary, propaganda, fake news, symbolic speak, and naked intimidation worked. And Parliament repealed the Stamp Act in the spring of 1766. But it was a tactical retreat, not a surrender to the growing sentiments of popular sovereignty which had been ignited by the Stamp Act. The repeal of the Stamp Act was accompanied by the so-called Declaratory Act, in which Parliament insisted on its rightful authority to pass binding laws on the American colonies in all cases whatsoever. To show the American rebels who really wore the pants, the so-called Townshend duties on commodities like glass, paper, and tea were passed in 1767. Not surprisingly, the duties sparked a new burst of angry pamphlets and letters. This time the rallying point of resistance became the 12 anonymous letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania, whose real author was the lawyer John Dickinson. Passing himself off as an average Joe farmer, Dickinson offered a sophisticated argument denying Parliament's power to tax its colonies. He also called upon his dear countrymen to rouse yourselves and behold the ruin hanging over your heads, unless they were to experience the fate of the Roman people in the deplorable times of their slavery. Newspapers like the Boston Gazette and pamphleteers like Dickinson also pressured local politicians and merchants into signing non-importation agreements in order to boycott English goods. And those who violated the agreements were named and shamed on print. But the Patriots not only fired paper bullets in the direction of London, but also at the local colonial governments, including Massachusetts Governor Bernard and Thomas Hutchinson, the Lieutenant Governor and Chief Justice. In August 1767, it became too much. Hutchinson was sick of being treated in the most abusive manner and vilified beyond all bounds. To shut up his bullies, he appealed to a grand jury to put the editors of the Boston Gazette behind bars for seditious libel. Hutchinson argued with Blackstone that press freedom was a great blessing, but only protected against prior censorship and did not include the freedom to slander and libel. He knew no more dangerous symptom in any state than when its rulers are slandered and the authority of those who govern is despised and trampled upon. Formally, the case was a no-brainer. The content of the Boston Gazette was a school example of seditious libel. But to Hutchinson's surprise, the jurors were unmoved. In early 1768, Hutchinson tried again when Governor Bernard was accused of being motivated by a diabolical thirst for mischief. But ordinary Bostonians had no sympathy for prosecuting their own and had evidently come to regard even fierce criticism of their rulers as legitimate. Governor Bernard then tried the old trick of circumventing the grand jury system through the legislature. But the House turned him down flat with this humiliating lecture in the principle of Cato's letter.
The liberty of the press is a great bulwark of the liberty of the people. It is therefore the incumbent duty of those who are constituted the guardians of the people's rights to defend them and maintain it.
Samuel Adams rubbed salt in Bernard and Hutchinson's bleeding wounds when, as populist, he gloated about the victory of free speech over tyranny in a column in the Boston Gazette.
There's nothing so fretting and vexatious, nothing so justly terrible to tyrants and their tools and abettors, as a free press. The reason is obvious, namely, because it is the bulwark of the people's liberties. For this reason, it is ever watched by those who are forming plans for the destruction of the people's liberties with an envious and malignant eye.
Despite being the victim of what he called an atrocious crime, Hutchinson finally gave up in the spring of 1769. American patriots had shown that freedom of the press turned fighting words into a potent weapon against authority, and that not even the world's most formidable empire could stop them from speaking truth, lies, and insults to power. Meanwhile, back in England, the notorious loudmouth John Wilkes rose to stardom by bullying the British government with withering criticism and satire. And the John Wilkes Show would prove extremely influential in America. To say that Wilkes was rowdy doesn't really cut it. The Earl of Sandwich supposedly warned Wilkes that you will die either on the gallows or of the pox. To which Wilkes replied, that must depend on whether I embrace your lordship's principles or your mistress. As an MP, Wilkes cultivated the fine art of ridiculing his political enemies. including one John Stewart. Not the guy from The Daily Show, but Britain's Prime Minister. In 1760, Stewart hired a PR agent to run a government-friendly paper called The Briton. So Wilke issued his own anonymous mock paper called The North Briton, with the sole purpose of needling Stewart and his government. He called the Secretary of the Treasury
the most treacherous, base, selfish, mean, abject, low-lifed, and dirty fellow that ever wriggled himself into a secretaryship.
The readers loved it. The North Briton sold 2,000 copies a week, or about 10 times more than the Briton. When Stewart resigned in 1763, Wilkes needed a new target and settled on the most dangerous choice possible, King George III. On April 23rd, he issued the now notorious North Briton No. 45, in which he lamented that the monarchy had sunk even to prostitution. George III was furious and wanted the responsible men behind bars. Facing prison, Wilkes went into exile across the Channel in France. Returning to England in 1768, Wilkes was elected to Parliament, but instead of being given a seat at Westminster, he was thrown in prison. But from his cell, Wilkes' popularity only grew. The cry, Wilkes and Liberty, was heard across England, and he ran and was elected for Parliament once again while locked away. Wilkes' trouble with King and Parliament resonated deeply in America. It pushed the same buttons as the Stamp and Townsend crisis. And Wilkes became an instant American hero. The towns of Wilkes Barre in Pennsylvania and Wilkesboro in North Carolina are even named after him. The two Adamses, James Otis and John Hancock, all signed a petition to free him from prison. Wilkes had provided the perfect script to populace wanting to advance their cause through the martyrdom of being persecuted for standing up to the high and mighty. And in 1770, the New Yorker Alexander McDougall starred in an American remake of the Wilkes affair. In 1769, the New York Assembly appropriated funds for the quartering of British troops. This did not please McDougall, who was a member of the Sons of Liberty. He issued an anonymous pamphlet titled To the Betrayed Inhabitants of the City and Colony of New York. It opened with an address to the minions of tyranny and despotism in the mother country and the colonies, who were indefatigable in laying every snare that their malevolent and corrupt hearts can suggest to enslave a free people. Clearly, with Wilkes on his mind, he called for his fellow countrymen to rouse and imitate the noble example of the Friends of Liberty in England, who rather than be enslaved, contend for their right. The authorities in New York condemned the pamphlet as an infamous and scandalous libel, introductive of anarchy and confusion, and subversive of the fundamental principles of our happy Constitution. When an informant revealed McDougall's identity, he was arrested and imprisoned. For the first time since Sanger, an American was charged with seditious libel. Like his British hero, McDougall got a cult-like popularity. Wilkes, McDougall, and the number 45, for the issue of the North Briton that got Wilkes in trouble, became synonymous with liberty and freedom of the press. Public stunts involving the number 45 became ubiquitous. At one time, 45 patriots walked in a procession to the jail and dined on 45 pounds of beefsteaks cut from a 45-month-old bull and finished with a toast to liberty and the freedom of the press. McDougall was even visited by 45 virgins who sang 45 songs. I'm sure there are many inmates around the U.S. today who wouldn't mind serving time on those conditions. In the end, the case dissolved as the prosecutor's witness died. But even if McDougall had been convicted, he had clearly won in the court of popular opinion by fusing the causes of press freedom and patriot dissent. If there was one thing which radical Whigs and their American admirers were absolutely certain of, it was the evil of standing armies. Good God, what can be worse to a people who have tasted the sweets of liberty, wrote one commentator. Call it an early warning against the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned against in 1961. which is quite ironic given the size of the U.S. Army today and the celebration of the armed forces by politicians, ordinary Americans, and popular culture. But in 1768, British troops were quartered in Boston, which fed into the fears of a standing army and its potential for subverting liberty. Anonymous Bostonians wrote reports about the oppressive occupation of the city, which were then systematically dispatched to other American cities and printed in local newspapers. The content of these reports was obviously one-sided. Poor, powerless Governor Bernard lamented the collection of impudent, virulent, and seditious lies, perversions of the truth, and misrepresentation. The resentment boiled over when British soldiers confronted an angry mob in Boston on March 5, 1770. Several people were killed. The event was quickly named the Boston Massacre and became a propaganda bonanza for the Patriots. Paul Revere published an engraving of the bloody massacre, which showed a line of menacing-looking British redcoats executing innocently-looking American civilians at the order of an officer. Revere's cartoon more than twisted the truth, and to ram home the point, the engraving was accompanied by an inflammatory poem cursing the murderous rancor of the fierce barbarians. Revere's 18th-century photoshopping went viral, further alienating American hearts and minds from the mother country. The Boston Massacre sparked a third wave of angry pamphlets and newspapers. Needless to say, the Boston Gazette took the lead, publishing more Revere engravings and writing influential comments portraying the redcoats in the worst possible light. And the renewed backlash contributed to the British repeal of the Townshend Act in April 1770. And then the angry pamphlet slowly calmed down. And for the next couple of years, it looked like the British government had managed to de-radicalize the Patriots. But then the British made the fatal mistake of granting a monopoly on the importation and sale of tea in the colonies to the failing East India Company. When the Tea Act was passed in 1773, new massive protests erupted, culminating with the Boston Tea Party on December 16th, when members of the Sons of Liberty boarded three English ships and dumped 342 chests of tea in the Boston Harbor. The furious British government struck back with a series of coercive acts in the spring of 74, including the Quartering Act permitting English troops to seize public and private buildings. The Americans rebranded these as the Intolerable Acts. In the words of John Adams, this was when the British government threw off the mask. Jefferson agreed. This series of British oppressions plainly proved a deliberate and systematical plan of reducing us to slavery. So in the fall of 74, the First Continental Congress met in Philadelphia to discuss the next move that would ultimately lead to war the following year. But the Continental Congress also served as a venue for addressing internal grievances among the colonists themselves. For it was not only the issue of slavery that painfully exposed certain inconsistencies in the patriot narrative of fighting for freedom against oppression. Unlike voiceless slaves, members of religious minorities could use the revolutionary dissent to their own advantage. If the British couldn't tax the colonies without representation, then why were religious minorities forced to pay taxes to established churches? The Baptist pamphleteer Isaac Backus bombarded the First Continental Congress with his pamphlet, Appeal to the Public for Religious Liberty. Many who are filling the nation with the cry of liberty and against oppressors are at the same time themselves violating that dearest of all rights, liberty of conscience. He rightfully pointed out that the same persons who protested year after year against being taxed without their consent imposed cruelly upon their neighbors and forced large sums from them to uphold a worship which they conscientiously dissent from. Robert Payne, a delegate from Massachusetts, brushed off Backus, arguing that there was nothing of conscience in the matter, it was only a contending about paying a little money. But that was exactly what the British claimed when the colonists protested that the Stamp Act and Townshend Act constituted nothing less than slavery. These appeals to principle and equality by religious minorities influenced James Madison, when he revised George Mason's draft of Virginia's Declaration of Rights to guarantee religious freedom rather than mere tolerance. Now, pamphlets weren't limited to the Patriot side. The years of 74 and 75 witnessed a regular explosion of Tory pamphlets. Like the Patriot side, Loyalist pamphlets were a mashup of recent documents, propaganda, and personal abuse, including accusations that Washington was involved with the Wash's daughter and those insidious rumors that John Hancock was firing blanks in bed. But as hostilities intensified, intimidation tactics became more systematic, and Loyalist printers and newspapers were increasingly silenced by what we might call the Patriots' veto. Robert Martin described these efforts as an active program of threats, public exposure, financial sanctions, and ultimately physical violence. This campaign had started prior to Lexington, when a newspaper in Boston was physically attacked for writing a bit too nuanced about how some patriots allegedly abused the non-importation agreements for their own ends. One of the editors was threatened and fled to England, but his colleague persisted with printing. John Hancock may have lacked libido, but he was more than capable of scheming. On behalf of the creditors of the Loyalist paper, he made sure that it had to fold due to economic distress. But when actual bullets were fired, Patriot intolerance of Loyalist paper bullets intensified. Now, the Bulwark of Liberty became the exclusive guardian of what Patriots viewed as true freedom's cause. The most prominent Loyalist newspaper was the New York Gazetteer, printed by James Rivington in New York. But shortly after Lexington, 75 men on horses charged and vandalized Rivington's print shop. But Rivington didn't get the message. So a few months later, a mob marched all the way from New Haven to New York to destroy Rivington's print shop and confiscate his type. Now that's a 3 days march. So the attack was hardly a spur-of-the-moment example of vigilante justice, but rather a deliberate and orchestrated attempt to silence Loyalist opinions. And it worked too, because the gutting of Rivington's paper was effectively the end of the Loyalist Tory press. Few on the Patriot side saw the intimidation of Loyalists as a problem. One commentator wrote that it was, "No loss of liberty that court minions can complain of when they are silenced. No man has a right to say a word which may lame the liberties of his country." Even Tom Paine and James Madison were on board with the Patriots' veto. Paine threatened a Loyalist printer who had published an anonymous attack on Paine with the noose unless the printer disclosed the name of the libeler. And in a private letter, Madison wrote, "I wish most heartily we had Rivington and his ministerial gazetteers for 24 hours in this place. Execrable as their designs are, they would meet with adequate punishment." Though with Madison standing at 5'4" and weighing 100 pounds, that's 163 centimeters and 45 kilos, I'm not sure being locked in a room with wee Madison would have intimidated Rivington. Where British or Loyalists still exerted control, they were happy to respond in kind. It might not be possible to persuade a grand jury to prosecute for seditious libel, but Virginia Governor Lord Dunmore didn't need a jury. He had men with guns, so his soldiers simply confiscated a Patriot printing press. And in 1774, when Boston was occupied by British troops and the fuse that led to Lexington was burning bright, anonymous Loyalists wrote a letter to the British troops providing names of prominent patriots that should be captured and killed. The letter finished with a P.S. "Don't forget those trumpeters of sedition, the printers Eads and Gill." The crisis evolved into a full-blown military conflict in April 1775, when the first shots were fired in Lexington and Concord. In the words of John Adams, this was when the instruments of warfare changed from the pen to the sword. And in August 1775, George III declared the colonies in open rebellion. In October, he accused them of plotting for independence. But the truth was that the Patriots still hadn't fully made up their minds. Were they truly fighting for independence? Or were they simply fighting to keep their old privileges, as Adams put it in early 1775? In May, George Washington promised that one might set him down for everything wicked if he was heard advocating for independence. But many of those still on the fence were pushed to join the Patriot side by some common sense. In early January 1776, while the Second Continental Congress was mulling over the future status of America, a new pamphlet took America by storm. Common sense made a merciless case for independence. "For God's sake, let us come to a final separation," the anonymous author cried. "The birthday of a new world is at hand." He also savaged the institution of hereditary monarchy, which appealed to the impulses of popular sovereignty and equality, which had fanned the conflict in the first place. The author was, of course, Tom Paine, who had only arrived in America from England in 1774. According to a member of Congress, common sense was greedily bought up and read by all ranks of people, and it sold 1,000 copies in the matter of a few days. Historians long recycled the claim that Common Sense sold 120,000 copies within 3 months and 500,000 within a year. But it seems these figures are based on Paine's own undocumented claims and later extrapolations thereof. One historian claims that 75,000 copies is the most and very optimistic guesstimate. Regardless of the actual number, Common Sense sold a lot of copies. And to those who actually bought the pamphlet, we should add those who read it in coffee houses and taverns, in newspaper excerpts, or heard Paine's arguments in town hall meetings or from friends, colleagues, and family. If Common Sense had been written today, the BuzzFeed headline might be, "Paine breaks the internet," or maybe, "Tom brings the Paine, destroys the loyalists." Common Sense worked magic on the indecisive Americans, though I'll leave it to historians to determine just how large a role Paine played in shaping history. But in April, Washington told his friend that, "By private letters which I have lately received from Virginia, I find Common Sense is working a wonderful change there in the minds of many men." Up in Boston, another colonist told his friends that, "Independence a year ago could not have been publicly mentioned with impunity. Nothing else is now talked of, and I know not what can be done by Great Britain to prevent it." On July 4, 1776, Congress approved Thomas Jefferson's draft of the Declaration of Independence. What could not have been publicly mentioned a year before was now a reality, not least thanks to a viral pamphlet. A slightly jealous John Adams wrote in a letter to Jefferson many years later, "History is to ascribe the American Revolution to Thomas Paine." Liberty and the unalienable rights of man were self-evident truths according to the Declaration of Independence. But Jefferson's stroke of genius didn't explicitly mention freedom of speech or religion. But soon after the Declaration of Independence, several states drafted their own constitutions and bills of rights. Three of them, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, explicitly secured freedom of speech, writing, religion, or all three. Virginia's Declaration of Rights was actually ratified on June 12, almost a month before the Declaration of Independence. Section 12 of the Virginia Declaration states that the freedom of the press is one of the great bulwarks of liberty and can never be restrained but by despotic governments. Cato for the win. But now that the people truly represented themselves and were free from both their former masters in Parliament and scheming ministers, a new question arose. Just how much should the great bulwark of liberty restrain the people's representatives? Should Virginians be free to subject their own representative to the same types of seditious lies that colonial governors had tried to prevent? The answer was yes, but... In 1792, Virginia's General Assembly passed a law against divulgers of false news. Which is pretty ironic, given that 6 years later, Virginia's General Assembly would vehemently protest the Sedition Act's prohibition of false, scandalous, and malicious writing against Congress and the President. And Virginia's protest was not only based on concern for federalism, but also on the Assembly's extreme anxiety to guard freedom of conscience and the press. Pennsylvania was the last, but also the most liberal state on free speech. In its Declaration of Rights from September 1776, it stated,
that the people have a right to freedom of speech and of writing, and publishing their sentiments. Therefore, the freedom of the press ought not to be restrained.
Notice that the Declaration secures both freedom of speech and the press. Given the extreme thin skin of William Penn and his successors, that's quite a development. No more public whippings on the marketplace of Philadelphia for provocative tongues or pens. It was all good and well that new states each erected their respective bulwarks of liberty by protecting freedom of the press and even freedom of speech. But in the late 1780s, many saw the need for a new constitution replacing the Articles of Confederation ratified by all states in 1781. The new constitution created a republic with a more powerful federal government empowered to adopt more laws binding on all states and citizens. The Articles of Confederation had guaranteed freedom of speech and debate for members of Congress. But with the new constitution, perhaps it was time for a federal bulwark of liberty protecting Americans from Congress. Join me next time for an expert opinion on the origins of the First Amendment and the dramatic events of the Sedition Act pitting Adams against Jefferson. Today's episode was patiently edited by Søren Staghøj, who has now put up with my late deadlines, incoherent mumbling, and recording and re-recordings for 22 episodes, spending God knows how many hours putting everything together. There would be no podcast without Søren, so thank you. And also a big thanks to Matthias Meyer for the always diligent research assistance.